This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown reporting here in Washington. The leaders of the Western Hemisphere's two largest economies are pledging closer trade ties as well as enhanced military cooperation. U.S. President Donald Trump even suggested that Brazil should be able to join NATO. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has more on the meeting between Trump and his Brazilian counterpart in Washington.
Jair Bolsonaro, known as the Trump of the tropics, said he comes to Washington as the first Brazilian president in decades who is not anti-American and wants to work with the United States to ensure the removal of Nicolas Maduro from power in Caracas. Trump reiterated, all options are open, when asked by a reporter if military intervention in Venezuela by the United States is possible. Bolsonaro did not make any references to an invasion of his country's neighbor, but he did say, we need to put an end to the suffering of Venezuela's people. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Authorities in the Netherlands are investigating terror as a possible motive behind a shooting on a transit train that left three people dead and five others wounded in the city of Utrecht. Police arrested a suspect identified as a 37-year-old Turkish-born man hours after a manhunt that ran several hours on Monday. He's expected to make his first court appearance on Thursday. In addition to the main suspect, two other people have been detained, but authorities have not detailed their possible roles in the attack. Gun violence in Utrecht is rare, as it is across the Netherlands. As the U.S. Supreme Court has endorsed the U.S. government's authority to detain immigrants awaiting deportation any time, potentially even years, after they completed prison terms for criminal convictions, handing President Trump a victory as he pursues hardline immigration policies. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. New Zealand Police Commissioner Mike Bush said on Wednesday the United States is among several countries assisting their investigation into the mosque killings, which left 50 people dead and many others wounded.
We have the FBI on the ground here. And in Wellington, we have the Australian Federal Police, the New South Wales Police, other Australian jurisdictions, but we're also working very closely with other countries, our other Five Eyes partners, in terms of cooperation around the profiles, the travel, etc., to build a comprehensive picture of this person that we will put before the court.
The commissioner said more charges will be filed against the 28-year-old alleged gunman, who has so far been charged with one count of murder. The police commissioner also confirmed they seized assault rifles as well as a semi-automatic shotgun after that attack. Cyclone Idai continues to heap misery on Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe, with hundreds of deaths and thousands left homeless across the three countries. The United Nations experts say Mozambique is suffering the brunt of the storm. Officials say the cyclone created an inland ocean across the country. Rescue workers were dropping food, fresh water, and blankets to flood victims stranded on rooftops and treetops and any high place of high piece of land, that is. The European Union announced on Tuesday it's sending an initial $4 million in aid to the three devastated countries. Britain has also pledged a separate aid package, and the U.S. Embassy in Zimbabwe said it is mobilizing to provide support without giving any details. Venezuela's self-proclaimed interim president, opposition leader Juan Guaido, is once again promising amnesty to security officers in the country who ceased to support Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The amnesty plan was submitted to consultation in January with committees of victims and non-governmental human rights organizations, which have already warned that the benefits cannot cover people linked to crimes against humanity, such as murder, torture, and political persecution, among others. Human rights groups have linked the security forces to extrajudicial killings, torture, and illegal detention. A rebel leader said the Houthis will never surrender Yemen's major port, Hodeidah, despite a UN-brokered peace deal with the government. Under a December ceasefire deal, the rebels and Yemeni government for both sides to withdraw their forces from the rebel-held Hodeidah and two other smaller ports. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabweans unite to ease the impact of Cyclone Idai as the death toll is expected to reach 300.
We gave a figure of 98 of our compatriots deceased. We expect that figure to rise because we hear reports that there are bodies which have been detected in this place and that place.
Nick Magwana is Zimbabwe's Permanent Secretary of Information. The death toll is also expected to increase in Mozambique. There's been protest in Algeria as a new deputy prime minister promises change. Uganda president sends a secret letter to President Kagame denying support for Rwandan dissidents. And Firestone Rubber Company in Liberia announces plans to cut its workforce by 13%.
The issue of redundancy have not been concluded. It's an ongoing discussion, and if the memo Fasun has in it, I will have concluded with that discussion, is far from the truth.
Abraham Dubed Nimene is the president of the Agro Processing and Industrial Workers Union of Liberia, and we'll tell you why the Kenyan Medical Association is calling on the government to cancel its medical training program with Cuba. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabweans have started raising funds and donating goods to provide relief to those affected by Cyclone Idai, which the government says has killed nearly 100 people and displaced hundreds more. Columbus Mayavunga reports from Harare.
At a local church, volunteers arranged donated items destined for places affected by Cyclone Idai in Zimbabwe. Food, water, blankets, clothing are all here. The volunteers then load them onto waiting trucks provided by donors to head to Zimbabwe's eastern border, where Cyclone Idai ravaged homes and left dozens dead. One of the volunteers, Johanny Chapungo Opos, is from the affected region. The 43-year-old man tells me that his former classmate and neighbor, together with the classmate's wife and three children, were buried alive when a hill collapsed on them while they slept. But my elder brother and our family survived. When they saw that that was about to happen, they quickly escaped, he says. I want to say that the food supplies there and where to stay are a challenge. There is nowhere they can buy because the shops are at the steep slopes, so they were destroyed too, he says. Tadzima Dzima of the non-governmental organization Ignite Youth says she's happy that Zimbabweans have responded to her calls for people to donate to ease the effects of Cyclone Idai.
We reached out to the youth in Zimbabwe. We went out on social media, mostly Instagram, because that's where we find many young people are. The response has been overwhelming. We plan to give everything that has been collected here to all the victims that have been affected by Cyclone Idai to help them, because we feel that this is the role that we have to play as young people as well, to give back, to help where we can.
The Red Cross is one of the aid organizations leading efforts to bring relief to Cyclone Idai's victims. Karikoga Kutadzaushe, the Zimbabwe Red Cross Society Operations Director, says his organization has deployed teams to ensure that the injured are treated and that there's clean water.
The situation on the ground is quite dire in that accessibility has been one of the biggest challenges, considering it's in the eastern and mountainous area, and there's been a serious landslides, damaged roads, and accessibility is one of the worst situation. To date, we have almost closer to 100 people. We have been confirmed dead. Closer to 250 are also currently missing.
Dabaningi Nick Mangwana, the government spokesman, told reporters that Harare had deployed army engineers to ensure that damaged roads and bridges are fixed. On Zimbabweans responding to calls on social media from organizations and individuals to assist victims of Cyclone Idai, he said,
"It's good that we've got such goodwill among Zimbabweans. It's good that we're all running together in one accord to help our vulnerable others, our compatriots who are in a bad state at the moment and in a bad place. The only thing is we need accountability. We know that in situations like this, they are the very fringe minority who will take advantage of the situation. That's why we say corruption is one of our issues.
Emergence workers have described flooding spawned by the cyclone as the region's worst destructive in 20 years. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa visited the affected region Tuesday. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Mozambique appears to have been the hardest hit by Cyclone Idai, which has ravaged southern Africa in recent days. Mozambique's president estimates that as many as 1,000 people have died, many of them in the port city of Beira. Meanwhile, neighboring South Africa has sent in soldiers to help with search and rescue efforts and is appealing to local companies to donate goods and services. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Mozambique braced itself Tuesday for a mounting death toll and a host of humanitarian needs in the wake of Cyclone Idai, which hit the coastal city of Beira on Friday before moving through Mozambique and on to Malawi and Zimbabwe. The initial official death toll stood at 84, but Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi announced late Monday, after flying over the affected areas, that he estimated the number could be as high as 1,000. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said in a statement Monday that the damage to Beira was massive and horrifying, and estimated that 90% of the city, which is home to more than 500,000 people, was destroyed. On Tuesday, Mozambique-based UNICEF spokesman Daniel Tima said the agency is still seeking information on the impact of the storm. He spoke to VOA via Skype from Maputo, the capital.
At the moment, still don't have a full picture of the situation, but we agree with the assessment of the government that the disaster is of a dimension which is much, much bigger than we thought in the beginning. This is due to the fact that information was coming in very slowly because the city of Beira had been cut off all communication lines and still is, and is also cut off physically because the roads to Beira are destroyed.
Nivuwa Mabaya, spokesman for the South African Department of International Relations and Cooperation, told VOA that members of the South African National Defense Force landed in Mozambique on Saturday to assist that nation's military in search and rescue efforts. South Africa will try to do more, he said.
We have also called on South African companies to donate for humanitarian assistance. And following this morning assessment, we'll make a further announcement of how we will assist going forward.
Tima said once the rescue is done, humanitarian agencies will still have serious work to do. To that end, UNICEF has appealed to donors for $20.3 million to support its response in all three affected countries. On Tuesday, the European Union announced it would release an initial emergency aid package of 3.5 million euro, nearly $4 million, to assist all three countries. Mozambique will receive much of that money. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A leaked letter from Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni to his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, has been circulating in the social media. In the letter, President Museveni denies allegations that his government has been supporting groups plotting to overthrow President Kagame. But the Ugandan leader said he accidentally met with one member of the RNC, an exiled Rwandan opposition party operating from South Africa. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali, the revelation comes amid heightened tension between Uganda and Rwanda.
President Museveni's letter to his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, was in response to strong allegations from his Rwandan counterpart while addressing senior government officials recently.
There are people who have been in a prison in their dozens, actually running into hundreds now. Some of them are in military prisons, others nobody knows where they are. Some have, and how did we come to know this? Almost every week there are people who are brought and dumped across the border. The best way to live there and be facilitated is to say you are there because you are against the government of Rwanda.
In the letter dated March 10 this year, President Museveni said his government cannot work with rebel groups to destabilize Rwanda. He wrote that he even rejected a support request from the Rwanda National Congress, or RNC, during what he called an accidental meeting with one of its members, Charlotte Mukankusi, in Kampala. I told her that we could not support them because what was happening in Rwanda was an internal matter of Rwanda. I explained to her that the stand of African Union is a scientific one and it is correct. Interfering in the internal affairs of sister countries is wrong because, first of all, outsiders cannot understand situations of sister countries well, reads the letter. Mr. Museveni also said that Uganda is a host of law-abiding and innocent Rwandans, but he said that he smells an invisible hand of Rwanda's security operations in his country. The letter reads, "What is wrong is for Rwanda agents to try to operate behind the government of Uganda. I get a lot of stories, but I will never raise them unless I have confirmed them." The Ugandan leader's letter to President Kagame may add fuel to an already flaming fire between the two sister countries because President Kagame says he has evidence of all allegations and that he briefed his counterpart on each and single thorn in their relations.
"We have evidence, and I have discussed it with my counterpart in Uganda. There are meetings we had in Addis Ababa, have a summit. We met twice on 2 days during the summit, directly we're talking. I have kept quiet about so many things, but tried to attend, you know, to them, pay attention, do my best, do this, and hoping that the best will come, and it doesn't come."
Since a standoff over the two countries' shared border began, some Rwandan business people claimed that not being allowed to travel back and forth to Uganda made doing business expensive. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Today's Wednesday, March 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. The multi-billion dollar Firestone Rubber Company announced this week that it will reduce its Liberia workforce by 13%. The cutback will affect approximately 80,000 workers. As Moses Gazier will report from Monrovia, the announcement has been greeted with dismay by workers.
When the story of Firestone's job cut first hit the newsstand in Liberia, the population was shocked and confused about the possibility that about 800 of their fellow Liberians will soon be jobless in the coming months. The announcement poses a threat to the George Weah government that is still trying to stimulate a struggling economy. In a brief statement issued Monday, Firestone said it made the decision after a thorough and strategic review of its current operations, coupled with unsustainable losses resulting from high overhead costs associated with the company's concession agreement with the government of Liberia, low natural rubber production as a result of the prolonged civil war in the country, and continued low global natural rubber prices. Firestone said it worked with the government of Liberia and the Agricultural, Agro-Processing and Industrial Workers Union of Liberia to reach the decision. But the workers' union said it never reached any decision with Firestone. According to the union's president, Ibrahim Dube Numeni, the Firestone redundant proposal and several others are still being reviewed by the government, the workers, and the company.
"The issue of redundancy have not been concluded. It's an ongoing discussion, and if the memo Firestone has in it, I will have concluded with that discussion, is far from the truth."
Nimeni placed some blame on the Liberian government for the current action of the company for failing to review some of the clauses in the concession agreement with Firestone to keep working. He, however, said the decision of the company is not timely because of the current tough economic situation in the country.
"Remember, the issue of redundancy is not something new. In the agricultural sector, there is a continual employment. But at this stage of our economy, it is not timely. It is not acceptable because it's going to have a consequence effect on not only on the economy, but the human group of our people, the workforce, the workplace, all those places are going to be affected."
In a very quiet Habel, the seat of the plantation, people shy away from our microphone fearing reprisal for speaking out about the pending job cut. but this man braved the storm to explain how workers were shocked by the company's decision to lay off some of its workforce.
We are shocked because according to the procedure laid down in the Decent Work Act, if you read our same Article 14.5, it talks about redundancy. One who is affected must be notified. And that has not been done. We should be notified on what ground the redundancy is going to be. We have to know.
The Liberian government is the largest employer, but Firestone has contributed significantly to the national workforce. The company also provides business social services like housing, health, water, and education for its employees. Moses Gazeu, VOA News, Monrovia.
Algeria's new Deputy Prime Minister, Ramtane Lamara, says the President Abdel Aziz Bouteflika has vowed to hand over power to whomever is elected to succeed him, following a planned national dialogue conference under the auspices of former UN envoy Lakhdar Al-Brahimi. Lamara says a new constitution and other changes to the current regime will be enacted, followed by elections, which have been postponed until next year. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Doctors and students protested Tuesday against the government of ailing incumbent President Abdelaziz Bouteflika in the Algerian capital Algiers and a number of other towns and cities. Various labor groups, including medical professionals and students, are calling for the president to step down next month when his term officially ends. Tens of thousands of protesters have gathered in the capital Algiers and many other towns and cities for the past four Fridays to call for President Bouteflika to step down and to enact fundamental political reform. Algeria's newly appointed Deputy Prime Minister Ramtane Lamara told journalists Tuesday during a press conference in the Russian capital Moscow that the current crisis in his country is what he called a family affair and that the government is ready to make changes to the current regime in the framework of a national dialogue conference. He says that current political, social, and economic conditions have pushed many people to demand serious change to the current system of government, and the government has responded by asking opposing political forces to participate in a national dialogue conference, which will create a new regime by consensus of all parties. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov insisted that the Algerian people must determine their own destiny and that outside parties must not interfere in the political process. Algeria's new prime minister, Nouredine Bedoui, has yet to name the members of his government, despite promises to do so early this week. Various political figures and trade union leaders have called on the government to step aside and for President Bouteflika to step down. Neither appear ready to do so. Algerian Army Chief of Staff Ahmed Gad Salah, who is a main power broker inside the regime, in a speech to military personnel Monday, insisted the army would not stand back and watch if the situation begins to deteriorate. He says that no matter how much the situation has deteriorated, there is no problem without a solution, and we fervently pray that everyone will behave responsibly in order to find that solution as quickly as possible. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Kenyan Medical Association has called on the Kenyan government to cancel its medical training program with Cuba. The call came after a Kenyan doctor allegedly committed suicide in Cuba. Until his death, Dr. Hamisi Ali Juma was undergoing training for a postgraduate family medicine certificate sponsored by the Kenyan government. But the Kenyan Medical Association says conditions in Cuba, where about 50 Kenyan doctors are undergoing specialized training, were not safe or supportive. Dr. Simon Chigundu is a chief executive officer and general secretary of the Kenyan Medical Association.
We do not know the full detail of the death and all. We've had doctors who are doing training in Cuba And they have previously sent a petition, which we have posted up in our site, about difficult conditions in Cuba. We think that this may have contributed to the sudden demise of our doctor colleague, and therefore we've asked for the ones who are there to be allowed to return.
But Dr. Simon, why wouldn't you allow the Kenyan government to ensure a full investigation is completed to understand the circumstances by which your colleague doctor is alleged to have committed suicide before making such demands?
We have not declared that we do not want any investigations done there. Indeed, investigations must be done. And an investigative process is a straightforward process where the investigators know what to do. But what we are saying is that when our doctors went to Cuba, we as Kenya Medical Association made a statement against the process in which this deal was made. And our statement is in the public domain. And we have been receiving complaints from them. And our biggest concern was the process and also that the course in which they are being said to be trained in is not recognizable even in Kenya as family medicine. We also have a recognized training of family medicine in Kenya.
Some of your critics are saying that the Kenyan Medical Association was not forceful enough to put pressure on the government to rescind this decision. Not until your colleague doctor died, the response or the pressure has been, at best, very tepid.
Not true. The Kenya Medical Association has its ways of raising concerns on issues, advising government by writing letters, and it has a national governing council which meets and makes a decision on what information should be given out. So it is very clear, if you go back to our records, we as the Kenya Medical Association gave a very comprehensive statement on the Cuban deal. It is in the public domain. So what we can do, we are not government, so we cannot force government to do what it is doing.
Dr. Simon Gikundu is the Chief Executive Officer and General Secretary of the Kenya Medical Association. He spoke with viewers Peter Clote from the capital, Nairobi. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. The multi-billion-dollar Firestone Rubber Company announced this week that it will reduce its Liberia workforce by 13%. The cutback will affect approximately 800 workers. As Moses Gaziewu reports from Monrovia, the announcement has been greeted with dismay by workers. Zimbabweans have started raising funds and donating goods to provide relief to those affected by Cyclone Idai, which the government says has killed nearly 100 people and displaced hundreds more. Mozambique also appears to have been the hardest hit by Cyclone Idai, which has ravaged southern Africa in recent days. Mozambique's president estimates that as many as 1,000 people have died, many of them in the port city of Beira. And that is it for this Wednesday, March 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samse O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Vice President of Malawi, Saulos Chilema. The Malayan politician and VOA's Shaka Sali discuss democracy and the upcoming elections. An in-depth look at Malawi's future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Thank you.